How can you achieve and maintain business growth? Harvard Business School Executive Education is now accepting applications for a new program, Driving Profitable Growth. Taking place in Boston from October 25th through the 28th, this program focuses on business expansion and organizational growth strategies that can lead your company into the future. Learn more about this three-day program for senior leaders by visiting hbs.me/growth. That's hbs.me/growth.
You are Locked On Thunder, your daily podcast on the Oklahoma City Thunder, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Well, welcome into a special co-hosted edition of Locked On Grizzlies and Locked On Thunder. My name is Peter Edmiston. I am the host of Locked On Grizzlies, joined once again after a Grizzlies Thunder classic by Fred Katz of Locked On Thunder and, of course, the Norman transcript. And, Fred, normally you and I would be doing this either in person together after the game or at least in the same city, having been in the same arena, watching the same game, which we have done before. And yet today I am in Memphis, but you, in spite of the fact that this game is being played in Memphis and Russell Westbrook was on the verge of his 42nd triple-double and it was a key game for seeding and blah, 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 you are in Atlanta, Georgia. Why the hell are you in Atlanta, Georgia, Fred?
Because Delta cares not about triple-doubles. Neither does weather. Neither does nature, and apparently neither do the beat writing gods, because I left at 5:50 in the morning. I pulled an all nighter last night. I had a 5:50 a.m. flight. I fell asleep as soon as I got in the plane. As we land, I look at my phone. I wake up like as we touch down, look at my phone. It's 8:30. I'm like, great timing. That's my connecting flight. Getting in Atlanta. Going to Memphis, and then I hear, well, welcome to Montgomery, Alabama. And it's like, what is going on? Am I half asleep right now? And I kind of questioned it, but didn't question my questioning of it. And then I went back to sleep. And I woke up like an hour later and we're still on the ground. And I was like, wait, what's going on? It says it's 9:30. Why am I still on the plane? What is happening? We're still in Montgomery, Alabama. The Atlanta airport was closed because of tornadoes and thunderstorms and lightning storms and everything of that sort.
Right.
And so we had to land in Montgomery, Alabama, and we were there for 4 hours.
Did you get off the plane in Montgomery, Alabama?
I did get off the plane in Montgomery, Alabama. I learned something today. According to TSA rules, they are not allowed to hold you on the runway for more than 3 hours. They have to give you the option of getting off. I learned that today because we were there for 4 hours. But I got off and I was like, I'm going to talk to a gate agent and see if I can get my, I had to check a bag. I was tweeting through this and I got a lot of responses of, this is why you don't check a bag. You know what? Try going on an NBA road trip for 8 days without checking a bag.
You've got to do that packing. There's like a packing deal where you can really you can roll your clothes and you can do that. What's that air thing where you suck the air out of and get the bags, like the space saver bags, and you suck the air. You can do it, Fred. If you really, you can do it. You can get it in a big ass duffel bag and you can probably piss off all the people that are in the plane with you because you're jamming that big suitcase that's way too big, but you're still trying to jam it in the carry on. But you could be that guy. That would work. You could do that.
You know what? Maybe your average, you want to know true irony right now? I've been waiting for a call back from – this is true. I've been waiting for a call back from Delta for 8 hours. That's how long the call has been, and they're calling me right now. So is it okay if I pick this up? Is
it okay if take it on the air. We'll just keep recording.
Okay, I'm gonna take this.
Okay,
and, maybe I'll – okay, I'm taking it.
You're good.
Hello?
Hello. This is the callback that was requested from Delta Airlines.
Literally requested at 3:30. It's 12:47.
He's on the line. Press 1 to speak to a representative.
All right, I'm talking to a representative. Okay. I do need to find out what's happening with my bag. Are we podcasting this right now?
Press 1, Fred.
Yeah, no, I pressed 1.
Oh, there you go. Oh, okay. Oh, good. I thought they just ignored you.
You are next to be answered.
Oh, next to be answered. All right, now because this is how Delta does this. I called so many times, and each time it was more than two. They say it's more than a 2 hour wait. Now, apparently it's a 9 hour wait. More than a 2 hour wait is like 2 hours and 20 minutes, maybe 3 hours, not a 9 hour wait. I called three times because I need to know what's going on with the bag.
And now you're still waiting.
This is either great podcasting or horrible podcasting.
boy, we're really skirting the line here. I don't know. I'm going to go with great podcasting, but if they don't pick up soon, if you don't talk to them soon, then I think we're going to get on the other side of that line pretty quick.
Delta Airlines, how can I be of assistance today?
Hi. So, I was on a flight today from Oklahoma City to...
All right, hold the line up over there too for me. I'm going to have to get another representative, all right?
Okay.
Thank you. Just a moment.
Another representative. Let's see if this takes 9 hours too.
This is exciting. I hope you get it.
I'm sorry, man.
Don't worry about it, man. You're good.
Delta's baggage information line.
Oh, God.
Sorry for the trouble with your baggage.
Oh, my God. Is this going to take 9 hours?
Which of these can I help you with? Delayed baggage, damaged baggage, a lost personal item, or baggage allowance policies?
What is delayed baggage?
If you're not... You said you were calling about delayed baggage.
No!
Sorry. Please say yes or no. You're calling about I'll connect you with a Delta representative who can help. So you know, your call may be recorded for quality assurance.
This is unbelievable, man. This has been the worst day ever. This is killer podcasting.
All representatives are currently assisting.
Oh my God, you've got to be kidding me.
Stay on the line. The next available representative.
You've got to be kidding me. Now I got to stay on the line for the next representative. It's going to take forever.
Thank you for calling Delta Baggage Service. We apologize for the delay in answering your call. Did you know the most current information concerning the status of your delayed baggage can also be found at delta.com/baggage?
No, it can't.
All you will need is your file reference number to quickly retrieve your information there.
Nope, that's not true.
A representative will be with you shortly.
Don't thank me for my patience. I'm actually getting quite impatient. They called me so they could put me on hold again?
This is amazing. Okay. All right, so we're going to pick up from here, and so Fred's had himself a hell of a day here, as he was just we were just talking about trying to get Delta on the phone, which we've gotten Delta on the phone, but now you are stuck in some level of customer service hell here. So while you're there, Fred, and you may have to duck out again at some point to deal with this. While you're looking for your bags, which may or may not be in Montgomery, Alabama, or Atlanta, or somewhere in between, they're not in Memphis. The team that you cover was in Memphis, and they knocked off the Grizzlies in what turned out to be a hell of a finish, an unbelievable showcase for Russell Westbrook, and really one of those games that. If you're on the fence about whether you think Russell Westbrook is the MVP or not, I know he didn't get his record-breaking 42nd triple-double thanks to one missed rebound. But man, 45 points, 9 boards, 10 assists, 5 steals, shooting 8 of 13 from behind the arc, 14 of 25 overall. I don't know, Fred. That to me, that's a pretty strong exclamation point on a hell of an MVP case.
You want to hear a fun fact?
Sure, I love it.
You know, Russell Westbrook now has a higher 3-point percentage than James Harden.
How about that?
For the talk of Westbrook's not a shooter, but Harden's a shooter. And look, I've been at the camp the whole time that if you think Harden's the MVP, that's great. That's fine. I can't argue against James Harden MVP. And I really don't know. I'm kind of glad I don't have an MVP because it's really hard. They're both just absolutely unbelievable. And it's pretty impossible to construct an argument against either one of them. But it is kind of funny. Westbrook's been on a hot streak lately. He's been shooting a lot of threes, and he's been shooting them well, and that's brought up his percentage a lot. But it's something that just watching him play, and certainly based on reputation, Harden takes more of them, but not a ton more of them. Westbrook takes more than 7 threes a game. It's not like Westbrook is, you know, doing this on a small volume of two threes a game. Like he's shooting a little, almost 35% now on over seven threes a game, which is actually better than what Harden's doing. Barely, by like a tenth of a percentage point, but it's a little bit better.
I think, when he's hitting threes, then forget about it. You know, there's really nothing you can do. That was what David Fizdale, Grizzlies head coach, talked about after the game. Fizdale is a huge Westbrook guy, and you know he really was an advocate for him. He's been an advocate for him for the entire season. He loves talking about Westbrook. He loves talking about the energy that he gives. And that was the thing, Fred, when you watch, like, you know, Westbrook in this game, I thought there was a fair bit of assist hunting that was going on, which is understandable given where he's at right now. He's six assists away from clinching the season-long triple-double, which he'll certainly do. I can totally understand that. But it wasn't like it was just about that. He took tons of very important shots at key moments in the game when the Grizzlies kept threatening to get back into it, kept threatening to overtake, would occasionally take the lead. And he would just time and time again, and generally it was dagger threes that were straight up ISO, nothing fancy about it, just a guy drilling a clutch shot over and over and over again. It was a hell of a like strong statement of a guy that just didn't want to lose.
Yeah, I mean, he drilled one right in Tony Allen's face basically for the dagger of the game.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just the shots to me. I mean, he was so hot from three. Like, he was hitting contested long pull-up threes, which is just, you're only going to do that when you're really feeling it. To me, the best play that he made down the, if you take all the best plays down the stretch, which was a bunch of them, there was the shots that tied at 91. There were, you know, the couple of threes. There was the steal on Gasol. To me, the best play he made was when he had that awesome crossover, went middle, and then found Doug McDermott for that three on the right wing, which gave them a 98-95 lead. And eventually, they never actually let go of that lead the rest of the game. That was with like a minute and a half left to go in the game. And to me, that was the best play that he made, because not too many times in crunch time is Russell Westbrook giving up the ball in that kind of situation. Now, granted, he was at nine assists at the time, and that was assist number 10. And it was, that was a great play. That was a sick crossover. He's not an Iversonian or Tim Hardawayan type of player in terms of a guy who's going to cross over a ton of guys. That was a pretty sick crossover.
Well, it was a good basketball play, as you pointed out. I mean, it did happen to be for his 10th assist, but that was the right play. I mean, and so many of his assists come from, you know, driving and just generating so much attention and then finding a guy. Now, often it's like a big, like a little dump off, a little drop off, and you know, that kind of thing. But this was a perfect look. It was exactly what the Thunder needed. And in this game now, I mean, the Thunder have clinched no worse than sixth, which, you know, it seems as though that's where the Thunder are going to end up. I think, if I remember, Fred, when we talked about this probably 3 months ago, 4 months ago, we kind of had it like this, right? I mean, I think we had Oklahoma City 6 and Memphis 7, and things have kind of gone back and forth, up and down throughout the entire league, but this has pretty much stayed, you know, where it is, and it looks like Thunder Rockets is kind of on the cards, barring a huge jump from the Thunder, huge collapse from the Clippers, who look like they're going to close out the Mavericks as we speak tonight. So that, it looks like that's the deal. Is that a matchup from a Thunder perspective that you like? You certainly have the Westbrook Harden thing, which is a beautiful one-on-one matchup, if nothing else.
I think it's going to be a great series. I think it could be the most attractive series of the first round, right?
It'll be the most, one of the most hyped, for sure. I mean, that's huge.
Yeah, I mean, you got the guys who are going to be number one and number two in MVP going head to head. You know, Harden's a former Thunder player. You've got Houston, one of the greatest offenses of all time. Just the way that they play, I'm not 100% sold on how close it's going to be. The Thunder and Rockets have played 3 out of 4 really close games during the regular season. Thunder beat them at their place one time, and the other two games were one possession. Oh, the first three games were all one possession games, which should probably say something to you. The fourth game was a huge blowout from Houston. They won by 12, but they were up 20 some odd points late in the game, and it was kind of a deceptively, you know, it was more of a blowout than a 12 point game, and they give up 137 points in that game. Houston scored 137. Houston in that game, I cite this all the time because I think this is just crazy. Houston in that game, through 3.5 quarters, had attempted only one mid-range shot, and it was a Nene fadeaway buzzer beater off an inbounds with 0.6 seconds left on the shot clock. And every other shot attempt was either at the rim or from three.
They've taken Morey ball to its absolute, well, maybe not its limit, but in that case they did, and they've tried their best to do it that way. It's going to be a fascinating series. I think the Grizzlies, from the Grizzly perspective of this game, I think it was a reasonable effort. Yeah, the Grizzlies are in a little bit of a weird spot, Fred. I mean, they've been, I don't know, kind of mentally up and down. And, you know, they've had this last 6 weeks or so, basically since the All-Star break. It's been a strange time for them. You know, Marc Gasol's injury has not helped. He's back now, but he's still not quite 100%. He said that there's a little weakness in his foot. He felt okay, didn't have any kind of reaction, but he had that strain. It's a fascia injury in his left foot, not the surgically repaired one, but the other foot. That's a problem. You know, not having Mike Conley was a huge problem. The Grizzlies have been really bad this year without Mike Conley, particularly since the turn of the year, where he is actually, as much as people talk about LeBron James being incredibly valuable to the Cavs, and he has been, if you look at net rating without that particular player, Conley has been more valuable to the Grizzlies in that time frame than LeBron has to the Cavs, which is not only a credit to Conley in what he's done this year, but also an indictment on how god-awful the backups for the Grizzlies have been for the most part. Andrew Harrison was okay tonight and was functional, did the best he could possibly do. Wade Baldwin, who looks up greatly to Russell Westbrook, was a little, I don't know, overwhelmed by the situation, but was not horrible. But without Mike Conley, you know, Fred, this Grizzlies team has really come to rely on him both off the court in terms of leadership, but also in particular on the court for his ability to generate points. And it's just it's hard for them to get points when they need them down the stretch without him out there.
Yeah, no, I mean, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, Marc Gasol is a great player, but I really do think that for the most part, a big man who has to operate out of the high post when you're running your offense through him, you're putting a cap on your offense. Like, I think the ultimate example of that in recent years, at least, was Joakim Noah with the Bulls in 13-14. Yep. He finished fourth in MVP voting that year, and everyone was talking about how great of a season that he had. And he did have a great season. And it was in part because Rose was hurt that year, and they lost their lead facilitators, and the Bulls basically midseason had to turn to Noah and say, we're going to run our offense through you. They ran out of the high post. He had a tremendous passing season. By pretty much any statistical measure, it's one of the best passing seasons of any seven-footer in the history of the league. It was a tremendous passing season. It was a great season. But because of the style that he plays, because of that kind of stoic high post style that he plays, the Bulls had a cap on their offense. And no matter how good Noah was going to be offensively, they just weren't going to score a lot. I think they were 28th in points per possession that year. And the Grizzlies are obviously better than that overall. And they've had stretches this year where they've scored great. Now, I'm not demeaning in that sense, but just when Mike Conley is out and you've got Gasol, who basically he's I think a better offensive player than Noah, if only because he's a better shooter and that sort, but he's operating that same sort of way. And it just kind of shows, like, when you have a guy who's going to operate out of the post that kind of way, it's really hard. It's really hard to reach a peak efficiency level with your offense. Like, you've got some kind of cap on it, almost no matter like how great that guy is.
Well, in today's NBA, it's hard to be that guy. It's hard to be that Noah guy that you're talking about. I mean, you're seeing like Jokic, you know, do a lot of similar stuff in Denver and, you know, facilitate through a number of different ways as a big man, but you still need to have the dynamic shooting and guard play to be able to orchestrate a lot of this stuff. And without that, you know, from the Grizzlies, they tried to manufacture it as best they could with Tony Allen, Andrew Harrison, to an extent, you know, as I mentioned, Baldwin. Some of the rotations were a little strange tonight. James Ennis didn't play in the first half, for example, and then he plays a little bit in the second half, but Wayne Selden playing a lot of minutes for the Grizzlies. You know, David Fizdale, it's kind of strange some of the decisions that he is making and prioritizing guys. I don't know if it's a conscious effort to push Seldon because he's a little bit he's a potentially better defender, even if you give up a little bit on the offensive end. Ennis has been more up and down. I don't know. There's some weird decisions like that because Ennis has been a more consistent performer and Seldon was just signed a few weeks ago. That's an odd one from him. Jermichael Green's minutes have been a little bit odd. He's nursing a shoulder injury, but he didn't even play all that much before the shoulder injury. So the Grizzlies, Fred, are in a little bit of a weird spot where I think they continue to be the team that I think they actually match up pretty well with the Spurs, really, from a playoff standpoint. You know, Zach Randolph tonight, for example, really, you know, led the way off the bench points wise, second leading scorer, played good minutes with Marc Gasol, but he's always a liability defensively, and he was again tonight against the Thunder, and you know that's why he was actually a team worst -8 when he was out there, even though he was very productive offensively, because he's just it's a problem for him, and the Thunder have exploited that before. Against the Spurs, it's a little easier for him matchup-wise, because they don't really have the personnel to completely annihilate him defensively. And as long as he can play a productive 20 or 25 minutes out there and not kill you defensively, he's a really tough guy to deal with and still a really valuable weapon for them.
Hey, do you think he's sixth man of the year?
Well,
Eric Gordon is a popular choice with that.
I think he should certainly be in the consideration. You know, I think part of it has to do with, I don't know if you're looking strictly at impact, at role, the fact that he, you know, rebounds in addition to scores. You know, a lot of guys are just strictly scorers off the bench. You know, he and Enes Kanter are basically the two leaders. I think Randolph's got him by one game, double doubles off the bench this year. You know, that's by that metric and by the metric of a guy that, you know, is willing, if you want to take the intangible of how well he has handled his demotion to the bench. And I know it's technically not a demotion. It feels that way though for guys like that. I think that's part of it. I don't know. I think the defensive stuff hurts him, but in that role, he's doing exactly what they need him to do, man. They want him to be a mega scorer in the post off the bench. In the mold of a lot of bigs that have kind of been doing that around the league, and yeah, he's done that. So yeah, I would have him. I haven't like, you know, scoured it yet, but yeah, he's definitely my top two or three.
I kind of feel like he's not getting a lot of recognition in that role.
He isn't. Though the Grizzlies are starting to try to push that a little bit. But no, he really hasn't. I think people just kind of accept what he is, and a lot of people are still kind of surprised to see him in that role. You know, I was talking to him last week, and he said that players come up to him all the time around the league and just are kind of incredulous at what he's doing off the bench and the fact that he's coming off the bench at all. But I think you're right, Fred. I don't know. I don't know that he's getting a lot of pop. I think it tends to always go to that scorer type, you know, whether it's the Eric Gordon or Manu Ginobili in the past or whatever. It's Jamal Crawford. That's the prototype of the guy that tends to win sixth man. It's not usually the rugged big coming off the bench.
No, it's almost never a big man. Has there been a big man to win it since like Detlef Schrempf? Like it's always
Detlef is a, you know, he's still a shooter. Even though he's a big man, he still is a guy that could shoot.
Right. I mean, it's always, I mean, you look at the recent
Vinny Johnson, you know, all those guys. Yeah.
It's Jamal Crawford. Even just recently, it's Jamal Crawford and it's Lou Williams and it's Jamal Crawford and it's J.R. Smith and that's Jamal Crawford again. And it's just like, it's these guards who are instant offense guys, you know, it's the Bobby Jackson types who are just these guards who are the instant offense guys and who are going to score. And like,
I look back, Lamar Odom was the guy, the last guy.
Yes.
It's a forward that would and even Odom is a, you know, he was a really good offensive player, so I don't even know that he would qualify in the same mold as a Zach Randolph or even a Enes Kanter. But yeah, you'd have to go back to like a Corliss Williamson like almost 20 years ago before you start getting into guys that kind of are burly big fellas that are getting that award.
Right. Now I'm looking at, like, you know, last year I was looking at voting. And look, like, Zebo is still an instant offense type. Like, he's not defending. He's in there for offensive reasons. And it's just a source of offense coming from your big man. It's not that different from Kanter, like you said. It's just a source of offense coming from your big man as opposed to from your guard. And that's kind of rare for a bench, because usually the bench unit, the guards aren't going to be as good at getting the ball to the big man, which kind of suppresses big man numbers and bench units from a points and just anything that involves having the ball. It tends to suppress those numbers. And that's partly why you don't really see the big man get it that often. But, like, so I got really pumped last year when I was looking through Six Man of the Year voting, and I forget who it was, someone, one of the New York writers, I forget who it was, put Ed Davis on their ballot. Not first, but had him third, I think. And I was, like, so pumped. I was like, yes, I didn't even necessarily agree with it, but I loved that Ed Davis was on there. Like, he defended, he had a great defensive season last year, and he was so important to Portland's bench defense. And I just loved that. I thought it was an awesome, like, alternative vote. I'm into the alternative votes. Like, Taj Gibson should have a Sixth Man of the Year. He should have won that first year. Jamal Crawford won with the Clippers. He should have won that year. And I don't just say that because I cover him now. If you go back and look at Bleacher Report Awards, I was writing for Bleacher Report then. I believe I was the only – I voted for Taj Gibson for Sixth Man of the Year in those awards. Because, like, I just thought his defense, his pick and roll defense, his rim protection, his screen setting, his pick and rolls were so important to Chicago. And I thought it was more important than just, like, an extra 16 points off the bench that you're going to get with another guard like Jarrett Smith or another one of those types. And you never see it. You never see it with the big men, even the instant offense big men. It's not a thing that happens. And it's going to be – Eric Gordon is deserving this year. Like, if I had a vote, which I don't, but if I had a vote, I'd probably vote for Eric Gordon anyway. But so I don't mean to knock voting for Eric Gordon. It just it hurts me that I would have voted for Eric Gordon. I support Eric Gordon because I don't want to see it go to that guy again, even though he really is deserving this year.
Well, it's just about the fact that it's kind of a lazy stereotype thing that always happens where, you know, everyone who – and not everyone, but a lot of times people that vote, you just kind of you fall into the same trap of voting in the template that's been voted in years past, where it's you vote six man, you just look for the guy with the biggest scoring average off the bench, bing bang, there you go. Maybe you look at a percentage, that was kind of the way that was done for years and years and years. And we have the capability now, I think everyone should, of being able to, you know, assess a lot more deeply. Look at a lot of different numbers. Look at different metrics. You know, figure it out for yourself. The role is different, and it's different for different guys. I mean, different guys have different things they need to do, but it's no less important. If you are if you are tasked to be a defensive big, and you come in and you are an exceptional defensive big, that's very valuable, and that should be noted. If you are tasked to be a scorer, then you'd be a scorer. That's great. That's important too. I mean, scoring is ultimately the name of the game. But yeah, I'm with you. Like, I don't think we should disregard that, but it's the same thing with, like, Coach of the Year. I mean, you know, you look at Coach of the Year, and, like, Jerry Sloan never won a Coach of the Year. You know, Popovich should be Coach of the Year most of the time if you're just looking at strictly the best coach. But it's always the coach whose team exceeds expectations by the most, and the expectations that are set by, you know, arbitrarily by people preseason without, you know, necessarily taking into account a lot of different factors. And you see so many times coaches of the year have gotten fired the next year. It's just it's a transient kind of thing. It doesn't really measure success by that standard. I mean, it measures something of a standard, but it's not really the same thing. I mean, it falls into that same kind of template where you're talking about, you know, who's really if you're asking, like, who's the best coach of the year, right? All that stuff. We don't really measure that. I mean, they're not really measuring Sixth Man of the Year. They're measuring best scoring guy off the bench.
So I've got this called up right now just for our reference. So we can actually back this up with some information. Mm-hmm. Antoine Jamison won in 2004.
Right.
Since that, in 12 years since, it's gone to a score first guard 11 of those times.
Yeah. There you go.
Lamar Odom's the only time where it didn't. It was Ben Gordon in 05, then Mike Miller, Leandro Barbosa, Manu Ginobili, Jason Terry, Jamal Crawford, then Odom in 2011, James Harden, Jarrett Smith, Jamal Crawford again, Lou Williams, and then Jamal Crawford for a third time.
There you go. I mean, that's it. So people just look at that. They look at the guard. They see the guy coming off the bench in that mold from years past. And that's what they look for. And they don't want to dig in. And a lot of these voters that have had their votes for a long, long time don't really want to dig in any deeper than that. And so they don't. And it just kind of perpetuates itself in the same way, which is unfortunate, because I would like to kind of, you know, challenge the paradigm on that a little bit. And we've started to with like the defensive player of the year. You know, that used to be just straight up like blocks, you know, who had the most blocks. But now I think we're kind of expanding our definition of what is a good defensive player and realizing that it doesn't necessarily have to be a guy that blocks 2.5, 3, 4 shots a game, whatever it is. So I would like to see us do that. And I do think Zach deserves some serious, some serious push. I don't, whether he deserves the award or not, I never like to get too deep into all that stuff because, like, I don't think it matters that much, but I do think he deserves a lot more push than he's getting right now. And I'm with you on that. And I think it would properly value what a sixth man is supposed to be, because it doesn't just have to be that scoring guy.
I would like to point out that I'm still on hold with Delta.
Well, you really screwed up with that whole delayed baggage thing that you inadvertently said it.
I don't think that's what it was.
It's on tape, Fred. I can go back. We'll go back and play. That's exactly what happened. I heard it. I heard the whole thing myself. That's exactly. No, it was like do you have an Amazon Echo, the Alexa deal?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So yeah, like, you know, it's like if Alexa hears the commercial for Alexa and orders something because you heard it. That's what just happened. Like, you were just inadvertently saying it, but the computer heard it, and now you're screwed. So
I think I was bound to be on hold no matter what my answer was, though.
I mean, we'll never know. You've posed a question that cannot be answered. that is beyond our realm right here. You're probably right. Knowing Delta's stellar customer service, you probably were inevitably going to be on hold all night there in Atlanta, but you kind of dug your own grave there inadvertently. I hate to tell you. Now, as we continue with this game too, the close was so typically Westbrook, and I was talking to, hang on 1 second. Excuse me, man. Sorry. I had to clear my throat there. I was talking to, a few folks, over at OKC side, and there are a lot of folks that really, there's a lot of push coming from Thunder folks to really, you know, make sure Westbrook gets as much MVP consideration as possible, which I understand. And I think that's right. It's right and proper this year, especially. But what we were discussing is just how absurd the amount that Westbrook crams into these games, that, you know, these are not, he's playing 10 minutes fewer per game than Oscar Robertson did. Oscar Robertson's, you know, records were in a league that had 120, 130 possessions a game. And, you know, you have 95 to 100 now. It's just, it's such a slower pace in that sense. And if you go back and actually watch the video of him, I posted some video of Oscar Robertson this morning. Like, there's no defense. There's no contest. Like, he gets these rebounds and he kicks his legs out like a damn gymnast. I don't know if you've seen this, Fred, when he gets this rebound. He grabs his rebound and he does the full-on splits as he's grabbing the rebound. I mean, it's like Draymond Green. It's way worse than anything Draymond Green's ever done. It's an unnatural. It looks like you're going for a gold medal. And he does this a lot. That was his famous kick. Like, get the hell out of my way. I'm getting this rebound. So, to try to compare what he's doing to, and I'm not trying to knock Robert. It's just a different era. So I'm not saying he's like, you know, I'm not saying he's a massively overrated. It's not any of those hot takes like that, but it's just more of a marvel and appreciation that this is even possible in this era. Cause it really shouldn't be.
So a way you can break it down mathematically, what you just said, is back then they didn't count possessions back then. So it's impossible to know exactly for sure how many possessions your average games are. They've been estimated at around 120. So let's make the math easy, and we'll say there are 120 possessions. That's 2.5 possessions per game minute, right? Exactly. Mm-hmm. 2.5 possessions per game minute.
That's right.
That means just in the extra 10 minutes a game that he was playing, because he played about 44 compared to Westbrook, who's playing about 34, just in the extra 10 minutes he's playing, he was getting about 25 extra possessions a night just in those 10 extra minutes. Now, the game was faster, too. So in the 34 minutes that they overlap, he was getting another about 15 possessions then extra than what Russ is getting. He was getting about 90 in three quarters of a game compared to Westbrook, who's getting about 75 in three quarters of a game, 100 possession game compared to 120 possession game. So when you add it all up, Oscar Robertson was possibly playing about 40 possessions a night more than Russell Westbrook is this year. And the fact that their numbers are pretty much the same really shows it. Like, imagine about 40 more possessions. You're just getting about 115, 110, something like that. And this is all completely estimated. But he was getting in that realm while Westbrook is getting in that 75-ish realm a night. And it's amazing that they're able to put up those numbers with that kind of difference. Because if you prorate Westbrook's numbers for 115 possessions, my goodness, they're going up 50%.
It's yeah. I mean, he would be in, like, you know, 45 points or something. It's like 45, 50.
He's like 45, 15, and 15.
Well, and I always bring this up too, because Fred, like I said, I genuinely am not trying to, like, denigrate the old timers or the old way. I mean, it just was different. So, no more would I do that than I would, like, you know, criticize baseball players for playing in the dead ball era and only hitting like 8 home runs. Like, it was different. I mean, it was just different. So I'm not knocking it. But the truth is that NBA players, whether people want to admit it or not, even going back to the 80s and Jordan and, you know, the early part of Jordan and Magic and Bird and all that, players play so much more defense now and so much more team defense now. The game, because of the rules, because of the way, you know, the offenses now flow, you know, team defense is such a priority. You have so many more things that you have to deal with as an offense. There's so much better scouting, preparation, all that stuff, better athletes.
And so, players are better conditioned now.
Yeah. They play harder.
Like when guys have to take off on one end of the floor, they're taking off on defense. And guys are no longer, I mean, forget about the fact that they are, you know, their health is monitored all every second, and in the off season they don't have to have part-time jobs and you know, just modern medicine and the way that they're brought up is so much better now in terms of just their taking care of themselves physically. Forget about all that. Just all you have to do is concentrate on the fact that guys are no longer smoking cigarettes at halftime, and you can understand why they're better conditioned.
No, I mean,
that's it.
Yeah. I mean, it's absurd to think about. They didn't play defense. I mean, they just didn't play it. I mean, they didn't. It's just it was not really a huge factor. You know, the possessions were all. It just looks different. It's so. I say all that to just really marvel at what we're seeing here. And I realize that, you know, the triple double is an artificial construct, and you could say it's whatever. I get all that, but it is something that has been around for a long time. It is something that is seen and appreciated in its own way. It requires a superhuman amount of effort to do. And particularly tonight, even though he finished the one rebound away, and they tried. My God, they tried. At the end, Taj Gibson was contorting himself not to get the rebound late on that one possession, but, I mean, he just couldn't help himself. He stole a couple of free throw rebounds away from Russell throughout the game that probably would have given Russ exactly what he needed. But to just see the effort and then the ability at the end of the game, his clutch numbers are so good. And, you know, to hit that dagger three right in Tony Allen's face, to do those things. And, you know, the crowd, man, look, the crowd was pissed. It was a great atmosphere as a result. He's a great on-court villain, even though off the court, by all accounts, a great guy. But he's a perfect on-court villain. I can't get enough, man. It's a compelling situation, and it's got to be a hell of a lot of fun to cover a season like this, because, I mean, this dude is something else.
It's amazing watching it every night. He was you know, I was not there for it, unfortunately, but from my Atlantan angle, He was Atlantan? Is that right?
I believe that's right. Atlantan? Yeah. Yeah, I think I'm going to go with that. I don't know for sure.
Weird.
Sounds good. Yeah.
Sounds weird. I'll call it my Atlantan angle. You know, he was great tonight in that second half, at least. I couldn't tell you what happened in the first half. Once it goes up on League Pass and I'm able to watch it, I'll be able to tell you. But for now, I can only tell you what happened in the second. And he had 7 threes in the second half. I mean, he was just – when he's shooting like that, the way that you can stop him is you can kind of goad him into those kind of shots, you know, contested pull-up jumpers. And if he's taking contested pull-up jumpers, you're not going to be okay because he's still Russell Westbrook, but you're probably going to be in the best shape you can possibly be in. And when he's hitting 7 of 9 threes and a half, it's just – there's nothing to do. There's nothing you can do.
There's no. I would tell you that, you know, the Grizzlies, I thought were reasonably okay. I mean, for the most part, defensively, I don't think there were any major huge errors. There were a few little problems here or there. It wasn't anything that was super glaring, but it doesn't take much. And, you know, there were some help. I thought Doug McDermott, you know, the Grizzlies really couldn't exploit him defensively, which is what you got to do. And they missed him a couple times, just kind of lost him. If you're going to look at any defensive errors, there were a couple of those threes that he hit. He hit three, and two of them, I think, were pretty much just squarely wide open from a blown coverage. That stuff with a guy like him is going to kill you. And if you can't take advantage, and there's really only one major time is in the first half where they really just burned his really bad defensive mindset. But other than that, I mean, they if he's going to be out there for 32 minutes, again, it's a little bit like, you know, on a different sort of position. But if you've got a guy that's that good and that single-minded offensively, and you can't take advantage of him defensively, in the same way that, you know, if Zach Randolph's going to be out there for the Grizzlies for a big chunk of time, you're going to have to do something on the defensive end to counteract what he can do. If you can't do that, then he's going to kill you. And I didn't think the Grizzlies did enough of a job with McDermott playing those kinds of minutes to really take advantage of him.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Not having Robertson out there is really hurts the Thunder defensively.
Oh yeah, and he didn't play much. Yeah,
and McDermott. Yeah, and he had to leave because of a sore knee. We haven't even really mentioned that. He had a sore knee and had to leave the game. But McDermott out there instead of him is just such a massive defensive drop-off. And he hasn't had a lot of playing time because of especially his defense off the ball. He's been getting lost a lot, and he gets screened up a lot. He gets backdoored a lot. He fails to recognize cutters in every which direction. And that's a major reason why he hasn't necessarily played. And he got 32 minutes without Robertson. And it didn't really seem like they took much advantage just putting him in positions to get lost off the ball in the second half, which I think is something maybe they could have done. That being said, they probably didn't – I mean, he probably wasn't that high up in the scouting report. Andre Robertson was – guys probably key in because they know he's a really good defensive player, and guys want to see, okay, here's a really good defensive player, and McDermott hasn't been playing that much. So I don't know if, you know, he kind of has to play in a pinch. I don't know if that's something that's so fresh on their minds, especially on the second night of a back-to-back when these guys just don't have a lot of time to prepare.
Yeah, that's part of it for sure. And the Grizzlies have had some known issues with guys that are not high on the scouting report this year causing them problems. There's quite a litany if you ask Grizzly fans. They can go through, you know, a whole bunch of them. I mean, it's been, you know, Solomon Hill. I think people still have memories of Solomon Hill just destroying the Grizzlies. But that's probably part of it. But I mean, like, you know, you play like Samaj Christian plays, you know, 23 minutes, and I realize the Grizzlies, you know, guard rotation was compromised without Mike Conley, but it was difficult for them to really take full advantage. It's a shame they couldn't. Because that was a good opportunity for them. Now, I mean, again, I don't know how hard, Fred, they were really going for that sixth seed. I mean, I didn't get the impression that last night, or night before, I should say, in San Antonio, that the Grizzlies were really pushing super, super, super hard for that win. I mean, I think they would have liked it, I guess, but I think they were probably mostly happy to just go ahead and take the seven. And at this point now, they've lost three straight, but they've been close. The game they lost in L.A. to the Lakers was you know, that's a terrible loss. And yet you look and the Spurs somehow managed on Wednesday night to lose at home to the Lakers, which is pretty amazing. The Lakers, who are facing a situation where, you know, they could lose not one but two picks if they fall out of the top three, are winning games. They're on a winning streak. This is unbelievable.
I'm on with Delta.
Oh my God.
Hello. Hi. I've been on hold for a while. I am calling about a bag which I need to retrieve from you guys.
So Fred was talking to Delta the whole time, and I think we've forgotten where we left off. But I guess I'll go with this, Fred. Do you think that in your heart of hearts, truly, do you think Russell Westbrook is going to be named the MVP?
Gosh, you know, it's so tough. I'm going to say no, because I just based off of Tim Bontemps' poll. Tim polled a lot of writers, and Jared Dubin pointed that out when I podcasted him earlier this week. And maybe TV people are a little bit more prone, I think, for Russell Westbrook for whatever reason. Writers are a little more prone to James Harden. But in Bontemps' poll over the Washington Post, which he did a few weeks ago, Westbrook has had some absurd performances since then, which I imagine have closed the gap to some degree. But Harden was leading by a pretty decent amount when Bontemps did that poll. And for those who don't know what I'm referencing, Tim Bontemps, lead NBA writer for the Washington Post, conducted like a straw poll. Bunch of people, not necessarily all MVP voters, but people who would be MVP voters and a lot of people who actually are MVP voters involved in that poll, just to kind of give a basic idea of what, whether you're an MVP voter or not, just the MVP voter like-minded people were thinking. And Harden won a decent amount of those votes over Westbrook. He got, and it was the same format. You list your top five, and he did the same point system they do in NBA MVP voting. And Harden got the vast majority. Got a really nice chunk of those first place votes and a really nice chunk of the overall points. So just based on that, I'm going to say Harden, but I feel like it's going to be closer than it was in that poll. I really do think it's going to be really close, and I'm not confident at all in that prediction. I'm really not.
Yeah, I think it's going to be an incredibly close race, and all I could say, Fred, is I appreciate your willingness to fight through all this stuff, and I can only hope that you're going to have a I can only hope your day tomorrow is going to be better.
Oh, it's going to be better. It's not going to be worse. I got to you know we didn't talk about the most absurd part of my day. So the League Pass feed crapped out on me, so I had to go to a sports bar. And I actually haven't told you this part. I was firing up League Pass and League Pass, the feed was blacked out. So I had to go to a sports bar. It's pouring rain, by the way, which is why my flight was canceled. It's like thundering and lightninging. And I'm trying to find a sports bar. I find a sports bar that has League Pass. I call like the fourth one I call has League Pass. I get there. I sit down. There's like 2 minutes left in the first half. They go to turn on the game. And right as they're turning on the game, the satellite cuts out because of the storm. There's no more TVs on in this sports bar filled with TVs. Every single TV is frozen. And I actually took a video of all the TVs being like, this is absurd. I just sat down and they went to change the TV channel for me. And now this happened. And I was like, this is absurd. I am just not going to watch the game. At that point, I was like, I'm protesting life right now and I'm not going to watch the game. And the satellite feed came back about 5 minutes later when it was already halftime and I got to watch the whole second half. But man, when that happened, I took a video, I sent it to my brother. I was like, there's no way this is real. This is just everyone is out to get me.
It's fall at JCPenney. Time to refresh your closet. This Thursday through Monday, get Levi's lowest prices of the season on 514 straight fit jeans for guys, $36.99. And select Arizona booties for her for $35.99. Plus, save an additional 50% off clearance prices already reduced by 60 to 80%. And get an extra $10 off with your coupon. Hurry in now. JCPenney. From valid 10-5 to 10-9, Levi's and other brands excluded from coupon. Clearance selections vary by store while supplies last. Savings off regular and original prices. Intermediate markdowns may have been taken. See store or jcp.com for details. Season refers to 9/27 to 10/18.